it's all right, it's good. So Dave, can you first tell me a bit about your background, like your family and when you were born and of your parents?
Well, I was born in 1943, which makes me the grand age of 40 this year. She wasn't very pleased. I wasn't very pleased, but nonetheless, I don't think she's got much choice about it. And my background was basically working class. My father worked on the railways as a single man.
In Birmingham?
In Birmingham, yes. I was born in Selly Oak Hospital, so I sort of was brought up in Birmingham.
Whereabouts in Birmingham?
Well, Sparkbrook we lived, and as far as I'm concerned, I lived there all my life until I got married. Basically a working class background. My father, as I say, worked on the railways as a single man, a relief single man that is, and it was one way of trying to earn more money, of course, because he did whatever came along at whatever time of the day. My mother was worked at a number of different jobs, obviously did her no more than try and boost the family budget. We was never well off. I think that my father and mother sort of got into a comfortable position when he was approaching the 45-50, and when we sort of left home, and he obviously didn't need as much money to live on, as they. So
was he in the union?
Yes. My father was a strong union man, as indeed I am. He regularly attended his branch meetings of the NUR. He was in the National Union of Railwaymen. And he was at the Saltley branch, and I think the Saltley branch has been widely recognised as one of the strongest branches within the organisation. And yes, I enjoyed one or two debates with him. I know people tend to think, well, if you've been brought up in a Labour environment, and you will automatically follow. But I don't think that's always true, because I think we're pretty much individuals and we form our own opinions as we get older. But nonetheless, I didn't differ from his position. He'd gone through the general strike, as many other people had done. He knew what unemployment was all about. And he'd always supported the unions, and unlike many, many people, he had always attended his branch meetings. I'm not absolutely certain, but I don't think he took on a job as a shop steward.
Right.
I couldn't be absolutely certain, because as a young lad, you didn't tend to make those sort of inquiries, but I don't think he did. But nonetheless, he supported the union very strongly. When he had little time for the conservative way of thinking.
But Labour Party rather than more left-wing?
Yes, I would say that, because he wanted to see pretty... I think people who were supporters of the Labour Party, it's awfully difficult to say or draw that line to what would be called extreme left-wing, left-wing, or moderate, or...
Right-wing.
Yes. It's extremely difficult, because I think most people, given a set of circumstances, will be extremely militant, given the right set of circumstances. I think my father would have been considered leaning to the left. I think he would have done, because he was pretty rigid in some of the things. And as I am, on education, on health and the services, pretty rigid on that. And I'm pretty much in the same vein. And he believed in the a social structure within the country have been to a degree equal as one another.
Right.
So I think I had a good grounding, and right from day one, I was an apprentice as a motor mechanic.
Oh yeah, what happened? So you left school at 15?
Yes, I left school at 15 and went around trying to get a job, as we all do. I don't think it's... I wasn't a brilliant scholar or anything like that. In fact, some of my reports was extremely poor, to say the least. But so I had no sort of set direction to go into when I left school.
Did you like school in general? Or were you
yes.
more
Yes, I liked school in general. And obviously I liked certain things better than others.
Yes.
I think a very happy childhood and a very stable one. I had a very stable, balanced home life as well.
Yes.
Which is awfully important.
You mean like holidays? And
yeah, oh yes, we used to go away on holidays. And in fact, we very, very rarely missed. Oh, I know my father had an old bowler hat and every week. The money went into the, you know, the old working class of saving money into the seam, under the bowler, and the bowler was locked away. Because, of course, we didn't have bank accounts in them days, like, you know. We went on many holidays, and of course, working on the railway, of course, we all went by train. Of course, it did help because my father got so many free passes, so it was only a question of accommodation when we got there. But very happy childhood, and I had no problems there. I never sort of got into any. I'd done all the usual things that kids do. Don't think I was a particular rogue, but I got into my fair share of trouble. But when I left school, I sort of hadn't got a sense of direction. I'd got one or two interests. And my sister worked at the Beezer at that time. She was the director's secretary. And some apprenticeships come up. And I applied for one, and fortunately was able to get one. After a couple of years, I was a tool setter. And after about a couple of years, I found that my real interest didn't lie in that particular trade. So after talking to the personnel, they allowed me to switch. So then I went on to being a motor mechanic and went through college. Day release, I went to college for a day and had to do 3 nights a week, which was a bit of a drag, like, because in the summer months when all your friends were there on the motorbikes, you was at college till 9 o'clock, half past nine. So it'd become a bit of a drag. But I stuck it out.
Where did you work then?
At the BSA. Sorry, we called it the Beezer, but it was the BSA, right. Birmingham Small Arms. We used to do the motorbikes.
What, on Montgomery Street? No.
No,
it's off the war. It's at the Coventry.
Oh dear.
The motorbike factory was small, wasn't it?
Smallly, because, you know, I can't think. Armory Road.
Yes.
Armory Road. Of course, it's pretty well gone now.
Yes. But I've met quite a number of people from the BSA. Mm. Ron Clark, I think, worked at the BSA.
That's right. Quite a few people. Here.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not very far from here.
No, it's only down the road. It's happy times there. Happy times. It was quite a firm that expected a lot of loyalty from their employees and never was renowned for paying particularly good money. As an apprenticeship, because I was moving around, you know, you had to do so many months in a shop and then you moved to another shop. Obviously, good training and I went round the complete works. So you never sort of become that close to a section that you got to know all the ins and outs of it. So they had a union there, of course, but I don't think it was all that strong at that time.
Did you have to join?
Not as an apprentice.
No.
You can if you want to, but there's no pressure to put on.
Yes. And you said you gave it up because you didn't like.
No, I didn't want to carry on being a tool setter. So after talking to them, they let me switch apprenticeships. So I then converted to a motor mechanic.
Right.
And then instead of going to Paul Green College of a day on tool setting, I went as a motor mechanic. And, of course, nights as well. But I passed them. So I'd got the necessary skills.
How different is that, then, from a tool setter? I know very little about this.
Well, of course, as a motor mechanic, you're repairing motor vehicles and as a tool setter, it's all tools and machines. You're repairing or setting, mainly setting tools, whether they be a lathe, a capstan, a miller, or a press. But, you know, that essentially is the difference. I'm repairing a motor vehicle as a guy setting up a press or a machine for a particular operational function. And I found I settled down on that. I liked it. And
How many years was that? 5 years.
I mean, I started when I was 15 and finished my apprenticeship when I was 21. So it was 6 years all told, but of course I'd had a bit of a gap.
And low wages then?
Oh, yeah, extremely low. I started on 44 shillings a week. Rising until I was 21, I had a massive wage of, it was just under or just over £7 a week.
In 1964?
No, that's right, 1964.
Did you live at home still then?
Oh, yes.
You couldn't afford
it? Yes, oh, I couldn't, there'd be no way, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, the most I used to take home about £1.50 or 30 bob in them days. Well, by the time you'd give your money to your mum, like, to pay your way, there wasn't a great deal left. And it was in the era where we had the motorbikes. So I wanted a motorbike.
Oh, yes.
So I had to buy one. And of course, once you buy one, you've got to pay for it, unfortunately. And that took quite a lot of what I was able to earn.
Yes.
So there wasn't a lot. I didn't get about much, I can assure you of that. I had to be satisfied with half a gallon of petrol in my tank and a ride round Birmingham, but we enjoyed ourselves, basically. Yeah. We never got into a lot of trouble, you know, with anybody.
Mm. You didn't become a Hell's Angel?
No, I mean, I had all the gear, you know, the outside outfit and
the leather and
the leathers and everything. I mean, you needed them for protection as well as show. But yeah, we did get a name, didn't we? You got a name as a mods, rockers and cowboys and Hell's Angels. Well, of course, that's the new name for us. But we never got into any particular problems with anybody. And we enjoyed ourselves.
So what happened at the BSA, did they?
Well, when I finished my time, I was a bit surprised, actually, because when I finished it, I was called into the office and said, well, you know, you finish your apprenticeship, what do you want to do? Because I thought I'd automatically carry on working for them. But I had to apply for a job then, which did surprise me.
That's quite common, though, but most people are surprised. But
yeah, I am surprised. But nonetheless, they gave me a job, and I carried on working, but at that time, of course, wages was important because I was only earning £13 a week.
Yes.
And that was pretty poor at that time. So I applied for a motor mechanics job at the Rover, as it was then, of course. And so it did surprise me at the time, but when I was interviewed, they told me I hadn't got enough experience, which did surprise me, because I'd just 6 months before completed the apprenticeship, I passed my city and guilds and got my credentials, and they said, we're looking for somebody with more garage experience, which I thought, well, okay. Well, I said, well, is there anything else, like, thinking that I could work my way into the department? And I started on what we know as second stage WD. That was War Department military vehicles. We used to do all the converting to what the army requirements was. And I was a bit annoyed.
On the body or the engine? The engine side, I take it from?
No, the vehicle.
Oh,
the complete vehicle.
Right, complete.
The complete vehicle. I was a bit narked when I found out that what they actually did here in their test track departments was, well, if... So when I found out what they actually did, I was a bit upset because, there was no way that you would need a garage experience to do what they're doing there. In fact, it was a big joke, but that was it at the time.
Mm. What were your wages then?
I started here, it was £22.50.
That's a big
which
rise.
Was a big rise from £13.
Yes.
In fact, I had to think to myself, how are you going to spend this money, Dave? You know. But it was a pretty good company then. There was a free and open atmosphere about it.
What was that shop like? Was it how many?
It was a small shop. It wasn't a big. It wasn't a big big production line. I would say that there was 30 people on that particular production line. So it was a smallish group.
Was that AUEW people?
TNG. Well, no, it was National... NUVB. National Union of Vehicle Builders then, because we hadn't amalgamated with the TNG then.
How did you become a member of
TNG? Oh, well, at the BSI, when I completed my apprenticeship, of course, then I joined the union, because he was a union chap, and he was... I wouldn't say that it was compulsory, but it was expected of you, and obviously because of my background, being brought up in a union factory, a union family, I joined the union willingly.
And it was all NUVB?
NUVB, yes. Well, there was a smattering of AUW and one or two other unions, but by and large it was in...
Oh, yes, Motor Mechanics.
Motor Mechanics, yes.
Sorry, so that was just on... So they were all in the union when you came here?
Oh, yeah. When I came to the Rover?
Yes.
All in the room, yes. She was, everybody was in the union at the Rover. It was a proper organised plant. That in with the union membership, I think that we've improved since I first came here. Our procedures, our organisation.
Yes, no, that's one thing.
It's a lot better than what it was.
Me. Yes.
A lot better communication. Although you always get people saying, you know, there's no communication, or it's bad. But by and large, people get to know what they need to know, and it's sometimes they know because they don't like what they're told.
Yes. Who was there a shop steward then, when you first came?
Are you talking about the group shop
yeah,
steward?
Yeah, and you were a specialist.
He was a chap called Dick Herbert. He was the shop steward of our group then.
Active for...
Yes, I would say active, because we worked on a piecework system then. So, obviously, every penny was worked out, and generally it was the shop steward who went and checked out the bonus and the payments made to make sure that it was A-OK, and quite a lot of them become very, very competent, and if there was a penny missing, there was a big ride, but that's only right and proper. If you've been paid wrongly, then it's got to be put right. Well, of course, we've got a different system in them days. Different rates and different grades. And it was as wide as it was long on the grade structures.
Even in your shop? Or was that more or less...
No, it was... Of course, we had track workers, production workers, which I was, and every track worker got a rate of pay.
Yes.
And storeman got one, and inspectors got another, and internal transport
but
got another.
But in that shop, it was...
But in that shop, of course, we had two rates. We had the ordinary production worker like me.
One and five.
Right. And then we had the floater snagger,
who
was 1 and 6. So he got a penny difference. It worked out to about £2 on the week. Of course, in that day, there was a keenness to become 1 and 6 men, of course.
Of course.
Because £2 was £2 in them days.
So did
if it's any comparison, it's about £1.95 at the moment. As against £2, £2.10 when I first started here, it's tremendous.
Yes, it's more than 10%.
But the value, too, is at that time, you know, it's quite a lot.
On £22,
it's quite... It was, and there was a lot of...
Not overtime, probably.
We worked overtime. There was big military contracts at that time, and they couldn't get enough. So there was a hell of a lot of overtime worked at that time. Every night and Saturday, practically without fail.
Was that just a side question? But was that also related to Elvis? Because they had just merged with Elvis in '65. They were big on military vehicles, of course, Elvis was.
Yes.
Or was it more lorry types and, you know, the sort of transport vehicles rather than fighting?
Oh, no, we... I mean, Elvis had their own vehicle range, and we didn't do any of their kind. We just built Land Rovers. The range was quite sophisticated. It's more sophisticated today, but we used to build a 12 volt and a 24 volt. The 12 volt was more of a personnel carrier. with the 24-volt beam of the radio-controlled vehicle as a communication centre. But it had all the normal fittings of machine guns and rifles, rifle clips, and clipping the rifle thing.
And really, one by one, they were made, were they, rather than in track?
Oh, no, well, what they, you see, there was a, no, they was built on tracks. But what happened was we built to a waistline position. In other words, up to a waistline, none of the final finish, it was just a basic vehicle. Then received the vehicle, and then all the cleats, the gun brackets, the jerry can, the wing stiffeners, the radio brackets, the radio tables. All this was put in by ourselves, and once we completed our part, then it was taken to the final line. And then the hoods, the canvas hoods, was fitted to it.
Then,
of course, it was sent to the army.
Is it a bit like SID now?
Yes.
That sort of...
Yes, but it was a track.
Right.
And we only did a military type of vehicle. We didn't do a commercial.
No,
car.
No.
We only did military vehicles. And there was big orders at that time.
Was there a lot of pressure to get the numbers out?
Yes, but because we was it was sort of self-motivating, because we was on a bonus, a piecework system. So people was always trying to get more bonus. We'd got a set target to work to. And obviously, if you wanted a bit more money, then you did a few more vehicles. But we had got a target each day. With our shop, we was pretty lucky, because not being like in a big area, we could self-govern our rates. So therefore, we said, well, how much do we want? Obviously, we was conscious of a money level position as well as a wage, because by doing more with less, of course, you increase your own individual money, but at the cost of labour. So we tried to strike an even balance. We used to aim at, when I first started here, we used to aim at about what we call 480%. It really was, as a system, you can't really relate to it, because, as you know, the payments was different then, and you had your national awards,
yes,
and everything. And that was pretty
low. The basic
low.
Rates were
the low. Basic rate was low.
Right.
And all the rest was bonus.
Yes, that all built
so
up.
As you increased, the bonus got out of proportion. And whereas you might have been talking originally from 0 to 100, you had to keep...
Yes.
To 200, to 300.
Every year.
Every year you had to keep increasing the ceiling on the bonus. So that's why, at the end of the day, you was talking of 880.
Yes.
As a bonus,
yes.
Which was ridiculous, really, but... It had to be done because of the payment system that was in...
To keep up with inflation.
Right, yes. Yeah, and of course, with the awards remaining constant,
yes.
Constant, it was such a low basic wage that to get a good...
That's part of the reason for the importance of the shop stewards, I think, in those days,
wasn't it? Yeah, it was.
Really, to keep...
That's right, you see, we didn't have too much... At least I didn't hear about it. There didn't seem to be the kind of disciplines which go on these days.
No,
it didn't seem to be apparent.
No.
Because
it was self-controlled, I think.
Possibly that...
That system.
Yeah, that system was there, and providing the company was able at the end of the day to get its production, it seemed to satisfy people.
Yes.
And at that time, we was the only manufacturer of 4x4.
Yes.
So the market was well secured.
Yes.
If somebody wanted a four-wheel vehicle, he had to come to Land Rover and order one. So the order books was always pretty, pretty full. I think we've paid for that now, but at that time there was no other alternative.
Was it so that such good work, that department, that people tried to get jobs in there? Like people from main assembly or...
Oh, yes, the main assembly was always the worst area. It was always the worst in payment and in general working conditions. You could walk in there today and the shell of the plant is not altered at all. The basic layout is not altered from day one. So they was always the worst paid with the worst conditions. And I wouldn't say the hardest work, because you was on this system and you governed your own rate, of course. The company had a target to reach each week. And that target gave X bonus, and if you wanted some more, you had to do a few more.
Yes.
That was it.
But you stayed in that shop.
But I stopped in that shop, and yeah, there's a keenness to progress into these kind of areas that I worked, for obvious reasons.
Yes.
And of course, we did ultimately become a 1-6 group in total. So once again, there was a keenness. It was what we call a progression area that a track worker who'd done his stint at the main shop could progress to. And there was quite a few areas on Land Rover at that time in this vein.
When did that progression come in, you think? Late 60s?
Yes. Yes.
And why was that? Do you remember anything specific? Like, it must have been quite something for you to be on the 1-6.
Yes, I think it was two directions. One, you was recognised as
skilled.
As having skill.
Yes.
You was recognised as having a particular skill.
Yes.
So there was some pride and there was some,
yes,
I don't know whether it's vanity or what, but there was something to be a 1-6 man. And of course it was the money.
Yes, I see.
The money, I keep referring back to it, but I suppose it's the single most reason why people come to get money to earn a living.
It was before the band system, that was it, the 1-6? Or was that with the band system that came in for you?
No, we had the band system then.
Well, it's hard to remember sometimes.
Yes, it's going back a few years.
If you could be, it's around that same time, isn't it? So it's hard to know. No, anyway, maybe that will come back. You can tell me next time. Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. Then I'll have a think about that.
Yes.
I'm not absolutely.
Yes.
Certain.
Because I'm quite interested in the way the abolition of piecework changed things in the factory, you see. Because
Well, of course, we didn't change the piecework system until 1970, 71, was it?
Yes.
About 71 when we completely converted from piecework to measured day work.
Yes, that was the band system then, wasn't it? No, it doesn't matter, it comes...
Well, it must have been in, wasn't it? Because we didn't go onto method direct until 71.
No.
So before that, we were still operating on the bonus, weren't we? On the first
work. Yes, but I was interested in the 1-6.
Oh, yeah, the 1-6 was there then, yes. Oh, yes, in fact, we went further than that. We had 1-3, 1-4, 1-5, 1-6, 1-7, and 1-9. 1-9 was a leading hand.
Did you have one in your shop too, or not really?
No, we had a foreman.
Yeah, because not every.
No, we had a foreman. We didn't have a leading hand. We had a 1-7 man. He was
sort of leading hand.
Well, people who got that was generally tin bashers, tinsmiths, and people like that. That was the kind of individuals. We got 1-6 for... You got 1-6 for two reasons. Floaty and snagging.
Yes.
And then you, for a particular skill, there was 1-7 applied.
Yes.
So, we had that kind of system for quite a few years. I became 1-6. Not only in the group, but prior to the group being my 1-6,
yes.
I became... A snagger and a floater and a snaggy.
Many shop stewards, I noticed, became floaters and snaggers. Or is that just a coincidence? Were you already a shop steward?
No.
Active union? Were you active in the union?
I would think at that time, no.
Which branch?
I become When I was at the BSO, I used to go to Branch Merchants.
Where was that?
That was down Small Heath. I used to be in Freddie Elliott's branch. He was the branch chairman, and I used to attend it. Because at that time, you see, attending a branch meeting, like my father did, it was a kind of a social occasion. It was on a Friday night, and it was 8 o'clock, and you told the girlfriend that, I'm sorry, I've got to go to the branch meeting tonight, I'll see you Saturday, because you went to your branch meeting, did your business...
With the lads, sort of.
With the lads, and then had a few jars on the way home.
Yes.
It was
in a
pub,
of course, yes.
Ours wasn't. Ours was in the church hall, actually.
Oh.
So we had to run. But they generally lasted till about 9 o'clock, past nine, and you generally had a few beers on the way home. So it was an evening out.
Yes.
And I know a few of them, you know, having in the pubs and during the day. But I wasn't really, when I came here.
Yes. What?
I wasn't really active in that sense. I think mainly because we were spread out a bit. We wasn't sort of... A Land Rover was made up of different departments. Not one big area. It was different departments. And of course you tend to act and work as different departments.
Yes.
And you can't avoid it. And so at that time I wasn't particularly active. I was perhaps more interested. I was courting. I was more interested in possibly earning a living and trying to move in a direction. I was thinking about buying a house and...
Yes.
Things like that, so
yes.
That seemed to take more importance to me than union activity at that time.
When did you get married and get a house and so on?
We got married in 1966.
Right, so that is...
Yeah.
You got your own house then, or not
yes.
yet?
Yes. Yes, we bought a house. We didn't have a honeymoon, like, we bought the house. We couldn't do two. So we bought a house at Ulster. Outside Birmingham, about 20 miles. So I was commuting every day, and of course that would limit whatever activities I wanted to get into anyway. And of course I did the normal things that you do when you get married. You try to build a house, you end up having children, and that sort of thing. But mind you, we were very happy out in Ulster. It was a nice village. And there were some friendly people, and I didn't find it.
Is that in Staffordshire? No.
Warwickshire. It's by Ragley Hall. I don't know whether you know Ragley Hall. It's out on
Warwick Way, is it?
No, it's Evesham Way. It's about 10 miles from Evesham.
I've heard, yes.
Very nice little village. I enjoyed living there. We lived there for about 4 years.
Did your wife work then? Did she keep
Well, yes, yeah, she found herself a little job at Ulster in a clothing manufacturer. I think he made overalls and things like this, and she used to work on one of the sewing machines, sewing them up. And she was quite happy there. Everything seems to be working reasonably well.
Yeah, and you lived far away too, so...
Yes, I lived... it was about 40 miles a day, 20
yes.
miles either way, so...
So you don't want to
so
come back
that,
in the evening?
That's right, I was limited, and quite frankly, I wasn't really interested at that time, because I'd just got married, I was...
Yes.
...got other things to do. And you can't do both. I think that when you take on the union role, it does put a tremendous strain...
Mm.
On the family.
Absolutely.
And your social life.
Yes.
And I think you need to be in a reasonably stable position with your family, otherwise it can cause major disruptions.
Yes.
And it has led to divorces.
It's a lot of sacrifice from the women, I think.
It is. In fact, I sometimes feel that part is not recognised.
Yes.
By anybody, least of all.
Yes.
By ourselves.
Yes.
Because we become
for some men it's easier when the woman herself is like trade union active.
That's
or
right,
political.
Yes.
But if it isn't like that,
right,
then it's really
yes.
So when did you become when did you get involved in the union?
I started to get involved It's awfully difficult to put a time on that, because we was all union-minded at that time. And obviously there was a lot of group meetings going on. So we was active from the point of view that we contributed to discussions and
yes,
whatever was affecting the group at that time. I started to become active possibly 1969, 1970, ultimately leading to taking on the shop steward's
yes,
job in 1977. So there's quite a gap
yes,
between when I started and when I picked up as a shop steward. We had one or two decent shop stewards at that time, and of course people was more loyal in them days to the shop steward. You had one individual, and okay, you always had a bit of backbiting and bickering, but generally speaking, you had a shop steward, and he served his span. There wasn't much change over in shop stewards. So there was possibly a bit more loyalty existing. And I think people was more union-minded in them days, borne about by experiences that they'd gone through.
Yes.
So I think they recognised that there was a need for a strong, active union to always have that present in the plant, so they were sort of like-minded to the individual who was the shop steward. Mm.
And you stayed in that shop, in that department?
I stopped in that shop until I left, because I had broken service with the company. I left the company, I formed my own company.
When?
That was in 1969, 70. So I left the Rover for a time, and I'd gone into my own little business with one or two friends. Tried to make a success, obviously very inexperienced and naive, and fortunately the partnership, we fell out with one another. Two of us were doing all the work, and one of them was carrying the other. And it ultimately led to a breakdown.
What sort of business?
In injection moulding and glass fibre fabrications. And as I say, we folded the business, and then I applied for a job back.
When was that?
That was in 71, 72. We were only for about 18 months. And I had about 10 weeks on the dole waiting to get a job back, because of course it was still a good firm, and it was known throughout the Midlands as a good firm.
Even then,
was known. And it was known as day shifts as well, Unravel, which was important, because we knew that a lot of the car trade was on a fortnight about, and that's one of the reasons why there was a...
Yes, so was the P6 then, I think.
That's right.
Last time, you know, when I talked to you, you said there were about 1,200 people now on the Land Rover, isn't that right?
Yes.
That's all. Now, how many stewards are there right now, roughly?
Well, of course, we've lost a lot of stewards now, people taking the VR or transferring to plant. With the cutbacks in programmes, there's been a loss of stewards because of our policies of last in the group, and some of the shop stewards have in fact been the last in the group. In the pleasant climate, then, it's not easy to obtain shop stewards, because people really don't want to take on, one, the responsibility that goes with the job and the time that has to be put into it, and two, I think there is a general feeling of fear that because they take on a shop steward's job in today's atmosphere, that will be seen as a black mark against them and could affect them in the future and in the job potentials and the general attitude of management towards them. So it's very hard to get shop stewards, and I would think they're on Land Rover at this moment is about 50, approximately 50 shop stewards, whereas in the past I had puts of 70, 80. We've lost approximately a third.
Yes.
A third of the shop shoes that we used to have.
And about a third of the labour as well.
Oh yes, about a third of the labour.
And last time you told me about the shop where you worked first, and then you had your own business, and then that was the end. So when you came back in 72, did you then start on Land Rover?
Yes. I started back in the main assembly shop. And when you start back, you go on the worst job, so you take your turn. So I ended up on the body drop. I was on that job for approximately 6 months, and then as you get a bit of service in, then you progress on to the better types of work. So I had a number of different jobs, and the last job I had on that particular group was what we call the steering, which is locking up the knuckle joints and everything, and aligning the steering wheel, and of course getting it on the right spline onto the steering box itself, so you get full lock each side. And then of course you have to equalise the back plate or backlash to get in the steering wheel so that everything is equal.
Yes.
I then applied for a snagger's job.
Yes.
But before you could become a snagger, you had to be a floater. So as soon as a job became available, then I was made up to be a floater, the 1 and 6 grade that we spoke about, the extra £2. Something to be sought after that time. So I floated for, I would think, about 9 months in the main assembly shop. Then some vacancies come up in what we call minor rec. Now, in order to get into major rec was where I first wanted to get to when I first started with the company. You had to progress through the different areas. You served your apprenticeship, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
So I was accepted into minor rec and I moved over to there. And that was basically a check on Land Rover's top and bottom. We checked everything just to make sure everything was as good as we could possibly make it. There was quite a lot of rectification involved. The name was minor and we was limited to what rectification we could do. Obviously we was in a flow line situation, direct feed to the vinyl line, so any big work or long hours that was involved in a vehicle, then that was returned to major rec. Mm. So they could carry out the repair. We didn't attempt engine changes, gearbox changes, things of this calibre. We wouldn't dream of touching because it would completely halt the flow of vehicles. And even when we was doing a rad change, we took it outside because a rad change was approximately 2 hours. Well, there's no way you could stop a production line for that period. Would cause major constraints. So what work we did do, we was in two categories. One that could be carried out and achieved without impeding the line, and two, one that would impede the line but was put outside and repaired at a point in time. And we'd got a couple of lads outside who took care of this, but obviously depending on how well the tracks was functioning determined rejects. And we had to do considerable amounts of overtime because we had a lot of vehicles, and it wasn't unusual to get a build up of 50, 60 Land Rovers stuck outside.
In a week?
Well, I would think the build up to that level would take 2 to 3 days to build up. And then, of course, we would have to work overtime to clear them as a batch. Pressure was on us to meet or keep the final lines in a well-fed position, and therefore it involved Saturdays and Sundays because the view was limited. I mean, most people only wanted to work an hour of a night, and you could only do so much work in an hour.
Yes.
When you was talking of 50, 60 vehicles, some which may require 2 or 3 hours work on, then what you arranged your patterns so that you could work on the quickies first and then leave the higher work vehicles later. And these was generally held back until the weekends so that there was more time available.
And that was all off the track, was it? They were just
That was off the track.
Yes.
That was off the track.
And a whole variety of jobs you did?
Oh, yes. It ranged from the most minor things of choke lights to two engine and gearbox changes, axle changes. In fact, anything that was required on the vehicle. If it was specialist, and when I mean specialist, possibly at one time we used to partially strip engines to repair. But obviously as production needs increased, then that was pretty much stopped, and we went for a unit change and returned the engines to what we used to call Tisley shop, and they stripped the engines and carried out the repair as necessary, and of course fed the unit back into the system. It was fitted to another Land Rover.
What was the atmosphere like in
those
shops?
Very good. There was a lot of friendliness. The shop was happy. We had our normal ups and downs like anybody. There's no set of human beings that can get on 100% of the time. And we had our ups and downs between us. But by and large, it was a very happy shop. We was very conscious that we considered ourselves skilled. And therefore, anybody that was brought into the shop, I think the shop and steward was more concerned and kept more of control over who came into the shop than actual supervision. And areas like test rectification was very concerned when we moved into a progression arrangements, whereby people who were putting good service on the tracks was enabled to progress through the areas and get onto these kind of better jobs. But of course, when we worked along that path, then people was very frightened, really. I think that was it, frightened that they would lose the particular skills. And there was a lot of resistance to allowing these kind of people into the area. Usual comments was, well, he's worked on one job for 15 years. One job he knows, but two job he doesn't. So there was a lot of resentment, I would think, when we started to move into that sort of thing. But I was all for it, because I couldn't see anything wrong. And after all, it was up to supervision who carried out the interview, because the progression arrangement was based on two factors, service and suitability. From our side, service, from the company side, suitability. So it was therefore the foreman or the superintendent to interview the individual and to determine in his mind that he was capable of performing, perhaps not all, but a fair variety of tasks which the department would be responsible for doing. And it was up to them to ensure that that was met. They didn't always do that. And I think that most of them used the excuse of the trade union's reaction to the refusal of the individual as a basis of saying, forget it, go in. So I don't really think that the progression was operated correctly, in so much that the supervision didn't do their part, because we as a union was quite prepared to accept suitability. But we accepted suitability provided that was what it was, and that the person who interviewed it could, if questioned, satisfy somebody like myself that in fact the man was unsuitable, and it wasn't just that he didn't happen to like his face or any one of a number of reasons which he may not have liked the individual.
Were you a steward in that area?
I was a steward. I wasn't immediately a shop steward in that group. I'd been in the group about 12 months.
About 75?
About 75, 1975. And then I took over as a shop steward, and I was a shop steward for approximately 2 years. Yes, 2 years, 1977, when I took over the job that I'm doing at the moment.
From whom did you take over? What was there? There must have been
a senior steward. During this time we'd always had a senior shop steward. George Hughes was
Was
the senior shop steward at the time. And he'd been there on and off, either in a deputy or senior steward capacity, for at least 20 years. And he was very experienced, very knowledgeable, and I don't really think that people understood his worth, because he wasn't what people perhaps pictured in their mind as a senior steward. He wasn't a devil with horns growing out of his head. He wasn't, or didn't appear, he appeared somewhat placid and calm. And whereas some people expected to see a fireball, I looked at him perhaps unfairly, and I know now he was unfairly, viewed him in the wrong light. Because he was a very capable man, there's little doubt about that. But I took over from George,
Why did you take over then? Was he already...
Well, obviously, we get elected every 2 years. And at the elections in 1977, I think the Shropshires was looking for somebody different.
Mm.
And my name was put forward. I hadn't seriously considered taking the job on before that meeting. In fact, I hadn't considered it at all. I was reasonably happy doing what I was doing at that particular time. Anyway, they put my name forward and I said, well, okay, because if I thought at all, it was on the basis that people ought to become shop stewards, they ought to become senior stewards. They ought to take their share, then do their time. Possibly that way, people from the shop floor would begin to understand some of the difficulties involved with being a shop steward, or a senior steward, or a convener for that matter. And that could well create this scene where understanding existed within the groups, shops.
Yes.
As against some of the bickering that goes on, and which one has to accept.
Were there particular issues at that time when you were elected? Like you said, people wanted someone else. What was it?
Well, the power of the trade union in this plant was, I would say, at its height in that time. And possibly some things was raised which oughtn't to have been raised. But was felt by shop stewards to be fair. George argued against them, rightly.
What sort of things were these?
And that, of course, created, I think to say unrest would be wrong. Resentment was the right word. Resentment against him as an individual, because you would get the usual sayings, company man, he's represented the company, he's not representing us, that kind of thing. Progression for one. A lot of shop stewards didn't even see that suitability should come into it. It was merely based on service. The company's right, or even the word suitability oughtn't to have been there. But common sense now tells me that he was absolutely right. That service and suitability must work hand in glove. And that if either one is not adhered to, then the deterioration sets in. And the area will suffer as a result. And it's not just the area, but the people in the area. Overtime rotas.
Because it's
safety problems. All this sort of thing was to a degree blown out of slightly proportion. And we had a very rigid attitude being portrayed by certain shop stewards. And common sense seems to have disappeared out of the window. And unfortunately at that time, we didn't. Possibly it was because I'd only just become a senior steward, but certainly we didn't sort of exercise the control that was necessary. And this sparks briefly on what we spoke about yesterday.
Yes.
That we had the power, but unless the responsibility goes with the power, then it's got all channeled in directions which really, at the end of the day, work against you. So common sense and reasonability has to be the order of the day, and people have to recognise that a factory has to run. It has to produce components, materials, vehicles, whatever it is. It has to be produced effectively and efficiently. And at the end of the day, it has to be presented to a customer in the best possible light, because he is giving his money for a particular item, and he wants good value for it. So that one has got to accept them principles. But that doesn't mean to say that people need to be unfairly treated, that they needn't have a role to play, that they haven't or can't have a well-organised trade union, which to a degree might be working hand in glove. But if we achieve workers' control, and one or two factories went to a workers' cooperative,
yes,
if we move in that direction, if we progress to ballrooms and places like this, then we then must accept the facts that a business has to be run, and ultimately somebody has to make a decision. and those decisions have to be acted on, and providing correct decisions, which are arrived at through common debate and common sense and sensible business practices, then they have to be accepted for that.
Was there a political debate at the time, like about yes, the politics?
There was more political activity at that time than what there is now. We had a number of people that was members of varying organisations, militant, the Communist Party. We had Spartacus, Trotskyists, as we call them. We've had a fair share, and of course, debates did become political.
Because of those people, you think?
Well, yes, I think so. I think so, because they was politically minded, whereas the rank and file was not so involved. He was not so worried about those sort of things. He was more concerned about himself and his family. So, yes, I would think. Although the debates was good debates, and one really couldn't fault much of the arguments that was going on, because if you was looking at a socialist society, the kind of things that was being said would be common practice in that sort of scene. And I've always thought that certain of these individuals spoke very well. They was controlled. They was guided in what they was looking for and what they was doing. It wasn't irrational.
Yes, yes.
Obviously, it possibly through their groups or cells or whatever they call them, they got an aim or a channel to go down. But you would very rarely find those people becoming involved in silly issues, stupid issues. The issue was a real one.
Yes, yes.
And they knew it to be a real one. And it was those kind of things that they became involved with, and which they debated, silly, irrelevant things. They just didn't want to know, because, of course, they was politically minded, and they was working to an aim.
What's happened now? That
well, most of them have gone. We've still got one or two.
What about the new right, as it were? I mean, the new right, people. Well, you know.
Yes, we do.
More openly support the Conservative Party or.
Yes, we do get that. We do get, well, I think we have to distinguish between what we mean by the Falklands War and the right. I'm not absolutely certain that it's a move to the right. I think that the average person became somewhat disillusioned with the trend. They become frightened, whether that was created by the press, by the media, television, but they become frightened of the left. I don't think they become frightened of many of the things they were saying, but they become frightened because they'd been told that they would be like Russia, if you like, strictly controlled by Big Brother, by somebody from above. And I think they become frightened, and so they become a general witch hunt. And there's no doubt everybody would have to agree that there was a witch hunt. And
with Edwards, you mean?
Sorry?
With Edwards, that sort of time, about 3 years ago.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think the shop floor had seen many silly stoppages of work, many times that they'd lost money for silly, stupid reasons, and they become tired of it.
Mm.
And they said, we're not going to stand it anymore. So they went to the right. They wanted to see strong leadership, because it hadn't been there previously. We'd been waving in the wind. They'd seen violence outside on the streets, increasing, crime increasing. They were looking for someone to stand there and say, this is wrong, we're going to do something about it. So they went in the droves, because the extreme right was the only body that was saying that kind of thing. And you have to think, well, what is it that affects the average man?
Mm.
And these are the kind of things that affect the average man. And that's why I think we had a move to the right, that people become disillusioned. They seem to think that the balance of power had gone, and many of the things, common sense things, was being pushed under the table, and they seen it as a way of getting back to some sort of balance that existed between the unions and the government. And they went in the droves. There's no doubt that tremendous amounts of people who would normally have voted for the Labour Party, in fact, voted for Margaret Thatcher.
Yes.
I think many regretted. Many regret voting on the basis of what has happened. But I don't think they regret voting for her because they still see that she is the person that would put some controls to deal with the violence and the increase in the criminal activities of certain people. But I think it was more that than the political side as to why she went, or why they went to vote for her. That's the general feeling that I get. Now we've gone the reverse. We've gone the reverse, and people are now seeing what it means to not have that balance and an active, strong, well-disciplined trade union, because that's what a trade union must be. Well-disciplined. And people like myself, not just because I'm here, it happens to be me today, it could be somebody else tomorrow. But people like ourselves, who generally have had the experience, who can apply logic and common sense, have to be listened to. By saying that, because we are democratic and we don't force people to do it, we have to do it through debate and through convincing people.
So that's... Because in some way, the way you became a senior steward, I think if, you know, I compare you to Joe and Martin, who have long, many years of trade union experience and political experience, that is quite a change, in a way. Because there you weren't even all that long on Land Rover, and already been put forward, you see. So, and as you said, you know, you don't have that commitment to outside trade unionism, which Martin has.